It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Run for Something. It's a progressive candidate recruiting group that sprung up out of the 2016 election. Its message is that if people want to change our politics, then they have to be that change. But it takes money to be that change, which often leaves working class people off the ballot. Our guest today explores why so many of our elected officials are wealthy and what can we do to change that. Nicholas Carnes is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, and his new book is called The Cash Ceiling, Why Only the Rich Run for Office and What We Can Do About It. Nicholas, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Carrie.
So I should note that in the foreword for your book, you say that you actually had this idea many, many years ago. It didn't come out of the 2016 election.
That's right. I started studying the economic backgrounds of politicians about a decade ago and, you know, noticed that, gosh, politicians almost all come from white-collar jobs and actually pretty high-paying white-collar jobs at that, at every level of government in the U.S. And so about a decade ago, I started doing research on how that affects public policy and why it is in the first place that politicians are so well off. So, yeah, this is not sort of just a 2016 phenomenon.
I want to clarify this because we're asking two questions here. Is the bigger question for you, why are there so many rich folks in politics? Or is it, why aren't there more any working class people in politics?
So I'm really interested in the second question. Why don't working class people run for elected political office? Obviously, there are lots of politicians who are millionaires and billionaires. And, you know, we could spend a lot of time parsing that. You know, why do we have so many attorneys as opposed to accountants? I'm really interested in what keeps the half of Americans who have working class jobs, manual labor jobs, service industry jobs, clerical jobs, what keeps them virtually excluded from political institutions.
Okay, so what keeps them excluded? Just
give
me your book. Just talk to me about your book. I know this is
here's the whole thing.
Right,
no,
exactly.
I'm really happy to. The basic answer in the book is it comes down to resources and recruitment. It is not the case that working class people are just less qualified. This is an explanation you hear a lot of the time. Oh, well, working class people don't hold office. It must be because they're not up to the job. I don't find any support for that explanation. And the other explanation my book rules out is that voters are to blame. So some people will say, oh, well, you know, this is a democracy. If only millionaires and billionaires get elected, or if working class people never get into office, that's just what the voters want. And the book shows that that's not really the case. When working class people run, they actually tend to do pretty well. What really happens is they just don't run in the first place. So your ballot, my ballot, usually doesn't include any or very many people who have significant experience doing working class jobs.
Okay, so I'm going to get into that in a moment, but I want to know if are there more working class people, say, on the school board or on a city council or town council, and it gets harder, you need more money as you go up the ladder, up the scale of political office?
That's exactly right. So if you look at the typical city council, you'll find more politicians from working class jobs than if you look at the typical state legislature or if you look at Congress. And the reason seems to be partly that resources just matter so much, and not just financial resources, not just the cost of your campaign, but really time and energy. This is the piece. Mm-hmm. So even in elections where candidates don't actually raise very much money, they're still investing huge amounts of these other precious resources we have, our time, our energy, our attention, our certainty about our future. And those are the resources that even in elections that are cheap in financial terms, those resources still screen out working class people at really high rates.
You still have to go door to door. That is still one of the best election strategies. And I know people who spend months just doing that as their full-time job.
That's right. And, you know, one candidate I talked to put it very directly when she said, look, you know, I have to work 40 to 60 hours a week to keep food on the table. I can't give up that time. And then the campaign on top of that is another 40 to 60 hours a week. And for a lot of people, it's just humanly impossible to do that. And so that's one of the big divisions that the book uncovers, is that working class people are less able to just take on the really basic practical burdens that are inherent in campaigning. If you work two jobs, you're just not going to be able to, say, well, I'll take the next 6 months off and run my campaign.
Mm. We are talking to political scientist Nick Carnes about why only the rich run for office. What are the consequences you see of government by the privileged for people who are not necessarily privileged? We're taking your calls here. 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. I should note that Nick is in, you are a scientist at Duke University. You are in North Carolina, where it is flooding right now, and you're calling from home. And we're hearing your kid in the background. How old is your kid?
So I've got my four-year-old with me right now. And, you know, he's going to be doing a little of he's going to be doing an app and playing with some toys here.
Okay.
While we talk. We have had some flash flooding this morning, and his school is on a two-hour delay. So.
And all of you are safe. You are safe in your home.
We're all safe. Thank you so much for asking. The area we live in has been spared the worst of it, thankfully. But everything's just been a little bit, chaotic for us this week.
I'm totally impressed that you are actually doing this interview. We've got a call here, Jeremy from Racine. Thank you for being with us, Jeremy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think one of the reasons why a lot of working class Americans don't run for office is they're too busy working. They can't afford to take time off to run a campaign. Take time off from work. Mortgage still has to be paid. Food needs to be fed to the family and what have you. So it's not so much they wouldn't want to. I just don't think they have the resources and the time needed to do so because they're just too busy getting by.
Okay, so thank you for that, Jeremy. So we just talked about this, Nick. There is this divide where we simply don't have time. But if we are going to be a democratic society, then everybody has to be represented. What are your strategies for getting beyond the I can't take time off from work to campaign?
So there are a lot of solutions out there for organizations that want to be creative. One of the most effective is just to recruit and support working class people. One of the most innovative solutions I've heard of was an organization who was trying to recruit a woman to run. She was a single mom. And so what they did is arrange babysitters to care for her kids, who were people who were already familiar with the family. Mm. To support her while she went out and campaigned. So it can be as simple as bread and butter support for people to, you know, basically continue living their lives while campaigning. To Jeremy's point, it really is the case that working class people are too busy working. There's not a deficit of qualifications, and there's not a deficit of ambition, and that was something else that Jeremy pointed out. In surveys, working class candidates will report that they are just as interested in running, just as confident in their abilities as equally qualified professionals. The big difference in surveys is exactly what Jeremy identified, which is working class people say, I can't take time off. If they can't take time off, we can start to think about what a reform might look like, and it might look like something like a political scholarship.
Mm.
Right now, organizations and political parties donate money to candidates to pay for their campaign expenses. But in many times and places, it's legal to donate to candidates to cover their basic personal cost of living. And where it's not legal, we could make it legal and set up political scholarships, essentially.
That's my cue to go to break right now, Nick. We've been talking to Nick Carnes. He's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, Sanford School of Public Policy, and he's talking to us about how working class people can run for office. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Only about half of the eligible voters in the U.S. vote regularly. A good turnout is actually about 60%, but even fewer of those voters try their hand at running for office, and even fewer of those who get elected to local office have the means to go higher. We're talking about why so many of our elected leaders are rich and how people might be able to change that. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Have you ever wanted to run for office? Did you try? If you didn't, what stopped you? Nick Carnes has written a book that we're basing this off of, The Cash Ceiling, Why Only the Rich Run for Office and What We Can Do About It. So, Nick, I've got a caller here, Dave from Schulzburg. Dave, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dave? Well, okay. Quick little story. Proud father I am, and my wife is a mother. Our daughter's running for the 85th Assembly up at Wausau, and God bless the Democratic Party for helping her. But as a first-time candidate, she has to raise $100,000. As proud as we are, I don't think she'll make the $100,000, but I know she's going to get elected because of the knocking on the doors and ringing the telephone every night after working a 40-hour week full-time in Wausau. It's a shame today what economics are in politics, but I believe she's going to show a young generation that it can be done differently, and then she's going to show them.
Okay, Dave. Thank you very much. How old is your daughter, by the way?
She's just turned 30, 31. She won't be tickled about me telling
anybody.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
That.
You didn't have to answer. Good luck to you and to your daughter. He brings up a really great question, Nick. It costs a lot of money. And also, a lot of politicians tell me that most of their time is spent dialing for dollars. And if you're the kind of person who wants to solve problems and not necessarily ask people for money, then you're going to be kind of turned off from running for office.
Yeah. So, to Dave's daughter, best of luck. It's really exciting to hear about young people throwing their hats into the ring. And, in that the case of that case, we sort of hear about just the burdens that campaigns impose on candidates.
Mm-hmm.
They have to go door to door and knock on doors and get to know voters and attend events and talk to the press. It takes over their lives in many cases. Add on top of that the added burden of raising $100,000 or more, and it starts to look like that mountain is just impossibly high. And when I talk to candidates from the working class, that is one narrative that I hear is it was almost impossible back when elections were inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
And as the fundraising burden goes up, the time required to run a campaign goes up, and I'm really screened out of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I find in my research. Places that have more expensive elections just ask more of candidates, and that's one more barrier to working class candidates or working class Americans running for office.
You talked about scholarship a little while ago. Is there some form of public financing that we need to actually look at?
Public financing is a really exciting reform, really exciting intervention in the political process. And candidates, to a one, every successful candidate I've spoken to describes disliking fundraising,
mm-hmm.
disliking dialing for dollars. It's not, believe me, it's not the candidates driving that part of the political process. When I've looked at states that implement public financing, for instance, for their state legislatures, I don't see any evidence that public financing by itself increases working class representation.
Mm.
And I think that reflects the reality that candidates describe, which is fundraising is just one extra burden in a process that's already extremely burdensome. And so, personally, I think public financing is a really exciting idea, but I can't say that there's any evidence that public financing by itself would increase the representation of working class people. I think it would be a step in that direction, though.
So we talked about working class Americans aren't running because they aren't simply asked to. I want to explore that a little more. How do we identify people who could run?
Well, so one of my favorite examples of how to do this is a candidate training program in New Jersey run by the state's affiliate of the AFL-CIO. And their model sort of builds on the apprenticeship model. So they take advantage of their federated structure, and the local offices all identify people with political talent and then inform the state office of sort of who those potential candidates are, and then work together with the state office to recruit those people to a candidate training program. So they're taking advantage of on-the-ground, really local knowledge, and then channeling potentially qualified people up into a candidate training program that's run and paid for by the state office. The last time I checked, the whole operation cost about $500,000 per year, which is a lot of money to you and me. I mean, that's a big amount for sure. But in New Jersey political dollars, that's just a drop in the bucket. I mean, that's literally 1% of what some candidates will spend to run for Senate in New Jersey.
Wow.
So this is, you know. And this model of just identifying, encouraging, recruiting, and training working class candidates in a very almost grassroots way has produced over 900 electoral victories. The graduates of this program have a 75% win rate.
Wow.
They hold office from the most local all the way up to the state legislature. So there really are models out there that work. But one of the troubling things that I find in my research is that political party leaders and other people who recruit new candidates will often pass over qualified working class candidates in favor of sort of more familiar white collar candidates. And that's another obstacle that working class people face. It's not just that running for office is really burdensome. It's that the people who could help often pass over them in favor of the attorney or the business owner.
I want to follow that up in a minute, but first I want to go to Tom from Neenah. Tom, welcome to the program. Tom.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi. I'm fine, thank you.
So your question?
You kind of touched on it just a moment ago, but I wanted him to expand a little bit upon it, and that is with organized labor increasingly shrinking, and the networking and finances that used to be available through that model, does that play a major role in working class people not running successfully?
That is an excellent question, Tom. So, Nick, we just talked about a program in New Jersey that that recruits or watches for people who have some political acumen. That used to be done in the union setting.
Yeah, so thanks to Tom for the question. And it is true that some labor unions used to, you know, do this work. I have sort of good news and bad news about unions. I guess bad news is that even back in the heyday of labor unions, very few of them actually recruited working class people to run for elected political office. Unions have a lot of jobs. They negotiate with management. They turn out voters. And candidate recruitment from the ranks of the working class has been sort of a curious, I would say, blind spot in the history of the American labor movement. If you look back when unions were stronger, there just weren't many working class people running. That's the bad news. The good news is there are real bright spots, real exceptions, unions that take candidate recruitment and training seriously. Now, I you know, could live in a place where, you know, North Carolina is a right-to-work state, so it's a state where, you know, union organizing is extremely difficult by design. Even here, I would say the encouraging news is that even in a place where labor unions are, you know, weaker or are prohibited from engaging in activities that would build their strength, organizations that represent workers can still do the kinds of programming that I'm describing. Mm. So it can be any organization that cares about good government, any organization that cares about the well-being of working people can identify, recruit, and train potential workers. It takes a little more creativity. It takes a little more relationship building and network building when you don't have those relationships and networks built in. But it's really not rocket science. And I say this because in a couple of instances, I've tried running candidate training programs here at Duke. And it's actually remarkably easy to run a program. Mm. You partner with an organization that professionally trains candidates. You find a space on a Saturday morning. You find people in your community who you think have political potential, who come from the kinds of groups you want to see in office. And if you build a good partnership, you can have a program up and running. I talked to a union worker in Nevada who in 6 weeks had a professional quality candidate training program set up and 20 working class people getting trained on how to run for elected political office. She had no budget. She had no time to set it up. But these things, you know, for a concerned citizen, for somebody who has relationships already with political stakeholders, it's actually not as difficult or intimidating as I initially thought to set up a candidate recruitment and training program.
We are talking to Nick Carnes. He wrote a book about why rich people hold office and how working class people can run for office. We're going to be taking your calls, 800-642-1234, in a moment. It's the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking with political scientist Nick Carnes today about why working class Americans seem to be scarce in our ranks of elected representatives. What do blue collar politicians bring to the table that white collar politicians do not? Or are you a working class individual who's tried running for office? How did that work out for you? Are you now an office holder? What were the biggest obstacles that you faced? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Nick, we have a few calls coming in, so I want to get to them. Matt from Nisida, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. There is a grassroots organization called represent.us, or Represent Us. They got me on a targeted Facebook ad. And they've got a very good plan. They've got a website. I encourage your listeners to go check it out. They've got very informative videos, and their goal is to get money out of politics and get corruption out of politics and encourage working class and other less common types of people to run for office. And by less common, I just mean not uber wealthy.
Yeah, no, I hear that. Are you running for office, Matt?
I am not. It's something that's maybe...
I hear yet. I am not yet.
It's something I might consider one day. But, represent.us. They got a really great website, and it's right along the lines of what your guest is speaking towards.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Matt. I want to get to this idea of representation and who represents us and what our society looks like when the people who are making the decisions are overly privileged. Talk to me about that, Nick.
Sure. So in kind of the first leg of my research on this, I was really interested in the old idea that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats and the business of the nation is business. And, you know, we all want growth, so what's the harm in letting rich people call the shots? Another version of that says, well, you know, it doesn't really matter who holds office. It matters how you pressure them from the outside. So, you know, if we could just, get the lobbying environment right, get people to the polls on election day, we could solve this problem and it wouldn't matter who we put in office. Well, my research has found is that it really does still matter who goes on to hold elected political office in the U.S. Politicians are people too, and even if you pressure them from the outside in all the ways we know how to do, they still consult their own values and judgment sometimes. And So we know, you know, John Boehner used to love saying on the campaign trail, I'm a small business owner at heart, and that's the perspective I bring to government. I think he was exactly right. I think he was telling the truth. Politicians are people, too, and their own backgrounds, their life experiences shape what they do in office. It shapes what problems they care about. It shapes what solutions they're willing to consider. And so, you know, I love hearing about organizations that want to fix the campaign finance system or the lobbying system. But I think what has to be a part of the reform agenda is changing who holds office. Even if we get all the money out of politics somehow, even if we get all the lobbyists out of Washington, I would say balance the lobbying system in Washington somehow. If millionaires are setting the tax rate on millionaires, if people who have always had health insurance are deciding whether to help people who don't have it, we're not going to get all the way to a political system that's really by the people and for the people.
You know, during the 2008 financial meltdown, there was a lot of push. There was panic, honestly, to stabilize the credit markets. And then we did a bailout of Wall Street because we had to stabilize the equity markets. Millions of people, though, lost equity in their homes if they didn't just lose their homes outright. Do you think that if more working class people had been in Congress then, that the aftermath of the financial crisis might have been a little different?
You know, I think so. I think one of the instructive comparisons, talking about the financial bubble popping and the housing market destabilizing, is the difference between passing the bank bailout, which was about $700 billion, and sailed through Congress, and compare that to the eventual $700 billion stimulus bill, which really was only barely passed. Both were important prongs of the federal response to the recession. Mm-hmm. And both were backed by, sound economic research. You know, both were, I think, to the eyes of macroeconomists, good things to do, smart things to do. Save your banks, save your financial industry, then stimulate growth by spending so that people can get back to work. Which of the two was controversial in Washington, where there are so many financial professionals, white-collar professionals, affluent people? It was the stimulus bill. The stimulus bill was hard to pass, and I think part of the reason is that if you're a politician, you understand, if you're a politician who has always known privilege, you understand the financial market better than you understand what it's like to be a working class person, what it's like to be out of work, what it's like to not have the money to pay your bills. And I think when we, think about who holds office, I like to say, and this is an old political expression, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Working class people aren't at the table right now, and that really affects how their interests are translated into public policy.
We are taking your calls right now to talk about why working class people aren't running for office more. We've got Terry from Green Bay. Terry, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Great topic here. I happen to be running for the state assembly here in the Green Bay area, and time and capacity is the biggest thing when you've got work life, 6-3 every day, kids, 3 kids in the evenings, split shifts still with the wife to avoid childcare costs. I mean, it's about time and capacity and being able to develop the interest in politics and being able to get out there, because I want to get out there as much as I can, and I'm doing everything I can to get out there and meet voters, but it takes a lot of time and capacity and, shoe leather out there knocking doors, and you can't always do that as much as that is the best part of the process. Mm-hmm. Getting out there to knock doors as much as you want to, every waking moment and every little sliver of time you have, you're out there doing something. So it's always about time and capacity. And with working families so much more busier, I think that's just a bigger challenge.
Thank you very much for that, Terry. Good luck to you, by the way. You want to answer him, Nick?
Yeah, best of luck, Terry. I'm really excited that you've chosen to run, especially given the challenges you described. I mean, I think this is the barrier that keeps just about anybody from running.
Right.
So I don't mean to exclude white-collar professionals when I talk about, the burdens associated with running for office. Anyone who's on your ballot has made huge personal sacrifices to be there. But to Terry's point, that is what my research suggests is kind of the first barrier to working class representation. Democracy, by its very nature, requires that the people who want to be considered for positions in government have to make huge personal sacrifices, have to give up time, energy, and time really stands out. It's the barrier we don't talk about. We talk about money. We talk about how expensive elections are. But I think Terry's point reminds us that it's really important to remember elections are always expensive in human terms, in terms of the sacrifices the candidates make. And that is going to uniquely disadvantage any segment of the population that just can't make huge personal sacrifices as easily.
We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Jeff from Burlington, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kerry. Good morning, Nick. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes. What is your question?
Well, it's an observation, and that is getting money out of politics. But that's been covered by the previous callers. I was very encouraged to hear about the training programs that Nick spoke of. I've been a local town supervisor for 14 years now. And our board is very mixed. We have a truck driver, a retired medical technician, a farmer. I'm in real estate, and the fifth member is actually the Register of Deeds for our county. And we find that having a mixture of people is tremendous because different ideas and different perspectives come to bear on the issues that come to us. I would also point out that when you're running for office and you're out there meeting the people, you also have to have done the homework. You have to understand the issues that they're going to ask you about. And that's another big time-consuming project.
That is an excellent point. Thank you very much for that. Nick, I have interviewed a lot of would-be politicians, would-be office holders, and I ask them about the issues, and they give me a very, very vague answer. And I think, why are you running then? If you know, are you running just because you want to have this office, or are you running because you actually want to change something? So that's a really interesting point that people need to be running for something, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one additional, burden that candidates shoulder is they have to be ready to speak on every issue affecting their community at a moment's notice. So I think that adds to the time burden.
And that also hinders people who aren't incumbents, because people who sit on the city council or the planning board, they know the ins and outs of why this bridge can't be fixed. Somebody running saying this bridge needs to be fixed, they don't know the ins and outs. So that burdens them even more.
That's exactly right. Once you're in office, campaigning becomes a lot less personally burdensome because a lot of the work you do to form a campaign is actually built into your job. And so what I find is that once working class people get elected, once they win that first office, they go on to stay in office for about as long as anyone else. So a working class candidate, once they're elected, doesn't seem to face any additional disadvantages. And it's getting through that first hurdle, getting into that first office. And after that, all the benefits of incumbency, all the, sort of daily updates about every issue in your area, regular contact with interest groups, with the community. Once those things kick in, working class candidates don't seem to, or candidates from working class jobs don't seem to face any special burdens going forward. The key is just winning that first election.
We are talking to Nick Carnes about working class candidates becoming politicians and winning election. We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. The phones are open. We're going to get to calls in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
In the WPR weather forecast for today, cloudy skies, rain and thunderstorms, some heavy at times, expected in the southern half of the state, highs in the mid-60s to upper 70s. Wednesday, cloudy with rain and storms likely, moving northward later in the day, highs in the upper 60s to upper 70s. Thursday, a mix of sun and clouds, some possibly heavy thunderstorms expected in the north and west, highs from the mid-60s to the low 80s.
Coming up after 8, UW-Madison School of Medicine and Health is doing a study on teens and media habits. The study is funded in part by Facebook. So what are they looking to find? That's after 8 on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Our democracy is led by a lot of rich people. In 2016, and really starting in 2010, we saw a popular uprising against that. Now more working class people are starting to run for office, but is the system stacked against them too much? We are taking your calls here, and calls are pouring in. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us. We actually have a tweet here. At WPR Mornings, we are talking to Nick Carnes of Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy about this topic. He's written a book about working class people running for office. Lori from Hales Corners, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. Good job. I am interested in finding out about McCain-Feingold. It didn't work. It went away. It was a bipartisan attempt to take some of that damn money out of politics, excuse the words. And can you talk about that? I am getting so many emails asking for money, and I'm listening to ads that make no sense to me at all.
Tell me about it, Lori. Thank you very much for that. McCain-Feingold, that pretty much went away with the Supreme Court decision that said we can't have corporations or people. You can give money to anything.
That's
from
right.
Anybody.
I mean, I certainly share this frustration with the sort of recent history of efforts to regulate the campaign finance system, especially post-Citizens United. I don't, you know, think that there's no hope, but my favorite comparison is to trying to get the money out of politics is like squeezing a balloon. You squeeze in one place, and the money just pops out somewhere else. So I think even if, my own sense is that people with money will always find loopholes, ways around the law, ways to, use their resources to support the candidates and the causes they back.
Citizens United said that that money is speech. So once that happened, is there really any way to control how much money is in politics? You can't if you say we're going to only run a campaign with public financing, and somebody else says I want to use my own money. There's no way to stop that, is there?
That's right. It's really challenging. I'm sympathetic to the people who say it's really going to take a constitutional amendment to really get a handle on campaign spending. What I focus on in my research is trying to find candidates who, in a sense, are money proof or money resistant. So when you look at candidates from working class jobs, what I think is really interesting and exciting about them is that even, decades into their political careers, and regardless of how much money they get or whether it comes from corporations or unions, they are consistently more pro-worker in their choices and in their behaviors in office than candidates from white-collar jobs. Now, that's not a solution to the problem of money in politics, but I do think it's a partial, if we can't cure the disease, can we treat the symptoms? And politicians from the working class, even when they play the money game, they still seem to represent the interests of working people better than other politicians. So if you're like me and you're sort of starting to wonder whether campaign finance reform is really possible, I would say, keep fighting for somehow getting a handle on the flow of money in politics, but also look for those candidates who are going to do the right thing regardless of how they have to finance their campaigns.
So, Lori in Hales Corners, thank you very much for that phone call. Ian from Milwaukee, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think this is a really important topic, particularly conversations about campaign finance. One of the things that comes out of a lot of blue-collar workers running for these positions of office is kind of expansion of perspective in the political realm. You get people from different perspectives. But what you see often, particularly in Washington, is everyone has like a law background. And don't get me wrong, if you obviously need that, that's important. But I don't understand why we don't see, I really can't think of a single politician who has, say, a sociology background, which is a topic where you're literally studying how societies can function together. I mean, that's always just boggled me, and I guess just because I'm a sociology minor, but I'm wondering why we don't see more of that.
That's a great question, Ian. We do see doctors sometimes, Nick, and we see lots of lawyers, but yeah, I can't name one sociologist in Congress right now.
You know, I can't either. A few political scientists come to mind, David Price and Dan Lipinski, but I also can't think of a sociologist in Congress off the top of my head. And I do think it's, you know, striking when you think about what the field of sociology does. It's about understanding how societies are organized, where our problems as a society come from. You would think, well, gosh, that might be a natural fit, some, you know, the type of person you would want in office, or at least one of the types of people you would want in Congress. I think what this really underscores is that the way we select candidates is not really by design, producing what we might sit down and think of as kind of the ideal mix of people, right? Getting into Congress is not about filling some important niche in the overall makeup of Congress. It's about winning a race in your district. I guess to put it bluntly, getting into Congress is not necessarily about who is the most qualified or who adds something missing from the institution as a whole. It's about who can win that race in that district, who gets the support from the local organizations, who has the time and energy to invest in the campaign. And we shouldn't be surprised that doesn't by itself give us the mix of people we might want if we were just sitting down describing the perfect Congress. It's really up to us to think through ways to, you know, if we don't like who holds office or who represents us in Congress collectively, it's up to us to think through ways to encourage and support more candidates, within our own districts who fill those gaps that we see.
We've got John in Thorpe. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
So I ran for office a couple of years ago, and an interesting experience for me was that I actually resigned from my job in order to run, and then was hired back by the same, actually, a school district on an hourly basis to perform some of the tasks that I had been doing in the district prior to running. And that became an issue in the media. I just thought it was interesting, and it sort of weighs on this idea of having the time to run. If you even go so far as to resign from your job, you might catch some grief for it. The other thing that happened that was interesting was that after the election was over and I had lost, I had quite a number of people say, well, you ran against the guy I liked, so I'm not going to hire you. I'm not going to offer you a position or interview you. And
wow.
In our very polarized political climate, I think it's difficult for people who are in a working situation as opposed to a business owner or an established practice to take that kind of a risk.
First of all, I'm really sorry. And second of all, thank you for calling in and sharing that with us. Nick, you want to speak to that? You got about a minute and a half here.
Well, so I think John's story, you know, underscores a lot of what we've been talking about. It's very difficult to take time off work, to give up your job, to run for elected political office. And I'm actually grateful that John was able to do it and that his old employer was willing to continue working with him after the fact. But I think it also underscores how, you know, I can definitely understand why the optics of that particular move could be blown out of proportion by citizens or by political opponents. I think if it underscores one thing for me, it's the importance of remembering that candidates are people, too. That politicians are people, too, that they have lives and jobs and bills to pay. And I think a lot of the time, especially in our increasingly polarized political environment, we're so quick to demonize the other side that we lose sight of the fact that, you know, John or candidates like John are people who still have to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
They still have to find a way to make a living. And if you just look beneath the surface a little bit at behaviors like, you know, taking an hourly job at your old employer, you start to see that they make perfect sense from the candidate's perspective. So I would encourage, you know, the listeners on this show to really keep in mind that the politicians on their ballots and the politicians they're reading about in the paper, they're human beings. They have to make a living. you know, they're facing real personal challenges when they choose to throw their hat into the ring.
Nick Carnes is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. His new book is called The Cash Ceiling, Why Only the Rich Run for Office and What We Can Do About It. Nick, we have left some questions on the table here that callers wanted to know. Don't successful people know what they're doing was one of them, and the other is third parties, so we can talk about that another time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.